The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first and number one global fintech show. This is Rachel Morrissey. I'm the executive producer of Breaking Banks. And this week, we are presenting a show that we did before a live audience at the Mobile Payments Conference in Chicago. We were joined by Travis Delaney, the co-founder and CEO of Push Payments, and Dan Gonzalez, who is the Vice President of Payment Industry Relations for the Federal Reserve's Customer Relations and Support Office, based out of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Travis has 25 years of financial services experience specializing in payments. He was part of the Fed's Faster Payments Task Force, has held executive positions at FIS, eFund Systems, Interliant. Dan also has 25 years of experience in payments and is currently responsible for helping many of the top financial institutions in the country to migrate payments to electronics and improve their efficiency. So before we get to that, I do have some conference announcements, so bear with me. Finovate returns to New York City September 11th through 14th with an expanded Finovate Fall program. You can register now at finovate.com and make sure to enter our special partner promotional code BREAKINGBANKS20. That's right, BREAKINGBANKS20 to save on the current ticket price. This year's PayThink conference is taking place September 18th to 20th at the Biltmore Resort in Phoenix, Arizona. You'll hear from a mix of industry leaders like Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Navy Federal, and innovators like Alipay, Uber, and Alibank. Listeners to Breaking Banks can get an exclusive $250 discount by using the promo code BREAKING. You can check out more details at paythinkforum.com. That's right. Go to paythinkforum.com and use the code BREAKING for $250 off. Now, next Money Chicago is September 26, 2017. The entire Breaking Banks family will be there. Brett King will be speaking. JP Nichols is hosting. Ron Shevlin, Jason Henricks, Jim Roos, and Duana Blomstrom are all on stage. You can go to nextmoney.org to register now. Registration has begun for BAI Beacon in Atlanta on October 4th through 5th. You heard them on our show last week. They have a particularly interesting track that they work on with Matteo Rizzi, who started InnaTribe. Well, he was one of them that started InnaTribe. We will be there, and our listeners can get a discount with the code B32. That's right. Go to BAI Beacon, register, and use B32 to get a discount on registration. And last but not least, we are going to be at Money 2020 Las Vegas on October 22nd through 25th. Provoke Media, which includes Breaking Banks, FinTech 5, JP Nichols' new show Serial Entrepreneur, Ron Shevlin's new show FinTech Snark Tank, are all pleased to be part of this exclusive podcast network for Money 2020. Look for the episodes of FinTech 5 in the Money 2020 website, and you can go and register now. They're about to have a price hike, so go and register today. You can find all of these on the BreakingBanks.com website on our conference page. Without further ado, I'd like to take you to the live audience show at the Money Payments Conference.
We are live, so this is exciting. So you know the eight words you can't say on live radio, right?
No, I'm not going to read them out.
Tell us. Okay. But anyway, we're going to be talking about mobile payments. So let's start off with a very simple question. What's the hottest mobile payments market in the world, do you think?
Well, we can precursor the maybe where you just came from. So it's obviously Asia as it relates to Alipay and the things that are going on over there.
Okay, so China's pretty hot. in mobile payments. So, you're not an expert, I know, on China per se, but for those of you that are unfamiliar with what's happening in China right now, we did have a discussion about this last night over dinner. And one of the really interesting things is mobile payments has exploded in China in terms of usage. There are entire cities in China now in terms of urban centers where cash is virtually not used. Plastic is not being used, but mobile payments is being used every day. We're looking at projecting about 5.5 trillion in mobile payments in China this year. And 92% of mobile payments in China are handled through two technology platforms, Ant Financial's Alipay. So that was the payments network built on top of Alibaba, which is sort of an Amazon equivalent, if you want to put in US terms, and Tencent WeChat, which was sort of like a Facebook equivalent, if you want to put it in US terms. So here's the question. We're going to do about $300 billion in mobile payments. That's the estimate for this year in the United States. Why the big difference, guys? Why does China appear to be so far ahead on the mobile payment stakes?
You want to go first, Travis?
I will take a shot. You know, in the U.S., I believe that it's been the most sought after payment environment and really ecosystem for a number of years, and largely because of the maturity of that process and the number of and volume associated with the payments industry. With that said, I'm a believer that our own maturity is our biggest Achilles heel, because within maturity comes regulation, becomes policies, becomes legacy systems that's been around for a while, and so you are, whether you like it or not, hooked into those. And a lot of the bigger players, and we can say the FISs and the processors and even the Visas and the MasterCards to some extent, their job has always been to hook the customer so they can't get out easy. So it really wasn't really built in a framework to allow for faster building, right? And so I think that the initiative that the Fed took as it relates to faster payments and so forth to actually speed up and really digitize our infrastructure is about cleaning our own house. Our industry is a little dated and a little legacy, and it has some things that's challenging. But as a result of moving to a digital framework, it's really about solving our own infrastructure issues.
So maybe let's, sorry.
No, so I was just going to jump in, and I think, so actually before I get started, I have to do my disclaimer right, so I don't get myself in trouble. So really, any opinions that are expressed are those of my own and not the Federal Reserve System, so just had to clarify that, so now I'm free to speak. But I think one of the things that Travis is highlighting is the complexity of the U.S. marketplace. So we have over 10,000 financial institutions, all the different innovators and fintech players, along with the traditional banking sector that's providing financial services. So very diverse, very different, where in some of these other markets, you can take one or two players, four, five, maybe even six, and you can really change the dynamics of how payments are made. That's not going to happen here in the U.S. It's going to take a little bit of a more organized process to think about how we go about making these changes. And as Travis alluded, and Travis was one of the key participants in the task force effort, with myself and 300 of what we kind of referred to as our closest friends. We were actually talking about the fact that the task force work has come to a conclusion, and we're not going to be working within the task force, but there's still a lot of work to be done. But it was a great effort to really bring various stakeholders together to talk about and look at ways of addressing these complexities and how we move the market forward.
So let's talk about that. You guys are both on the faster payments. Well, the task force, as you said, sure, is coming to a completion, and we're now looking at implementation. But the reality is one of the reasons China has been able to move so quickly is that China could just push out this regulation. And in where we see faster payments networks emerging in the UK, for example, you've got the same situation where standards can be mandated on the market fairly easily. But we have this problem of consensus because of the system in the US that sort of takes us longer. Is that a disadvantage at this point with the technologies around payments moving so quickly?
So let me take a stab at it, and you feel free to jump in. But you know, our feeling has always been that this is going to be a market-driven initiative, and bringing those different stakeholders and players to the forefront, getting the input and feedback from those is actually going to create a stronger end result. So one of the key things that the task force did was create effectiveness criteria. So they came up with 36 different criteria, which essentially address stakeholder needs for what a real-time payments capability could look like in the U.S. marketplace. And they identified those needs, and it was driven from the various stakeholders within the task force, which included not only financial institutions, non-bank service providers, but consumer interest organizations and merchants, as well as corporates. So bringing in all those different perspectives really helped to inform those effectiveness criteria to say, if we had the capability to build something from scratch, here's kind of what we'd like to see for faster payments capabilities in the U.S. So again, a little different than maybe some approach that other countries have taken through a mandate approach. We're doing it more collaboratively, and the role the Fed has been playing in that has really been around the leader catalyst role, helping to bring these parties together to drive this change through market innovation.
With that said, though, don't kid yourself that when we all got it on these calls and even in person, one of the very biggest issues right off the bat was we got to fix regulatory issues because they come from different bodies, right? So the Federal Reserve doesn't set every single thing that's going on. There's the OCC. There's a lot of different agencies that build that up. So, you know, in the end, what's happened ultimately is we've got a convergence of industries, you know, payments and fintech and financial services is all coming together now. They were all regulated separately. Right, so regulation is a stifle. As a startup, I can tell you that it is challenging. Now, I'm like water. I will find a way. But it is a matter of blocking and tackling a little bit because certain regulations were built for a certain reason. And don't forget that regulatory mindset in the first place is reactive. Right. Most of the time, rules are put in place because something happened. We got to fix that. Don't want that happen again.
Risk mitigation.
Yeah, well, it's a form of risk mitigation. So it's not proactive and emptive in that case. So you're taking a culture and you have to change it to an ideology. And how do you do that? Right? Because just the standard nature of risk mitigation, the individuals even playing those roles, 80% of them actually, I think, was predispositioned and born to say no first, right? And it's just, it's a cultural change. I think it's bigger than that, right? And so not having regulation in these other countries allows them to leap over that, and they didn't have some of the same challenges, right? So it is a, you know, even when I joke about the task force a little bit, because in the beginning, they kind of came in and says, all right, guys, you know, kind of y'all get along and figure this thing out, because if you don't, we're going to tell you what to do, right? And when you put a bunch of processors and people in payment industry, you know, being almost threatened to say, okay, we're going to regulate you to do this and you won't have a choice, or you decide, guess what? We all work together. So, you know, but there is a medium, but there is pulse. There's strong pulse. I mean, you can look at the banking industry itself, and you take a community bank and you take a large FI, and they are polar opposites in what they're interested in, right? So, and when we talk about numbers, 58 to 8,000 community banks in the United States, that's a lot of banks, and their job, for the most part, is serving the people in the community they live in.
Right. So, I mean, when we look at this historically with, ACH, the ACH network, I mean, there was resistance from the incumbents to, sort of more increasing settlement on ACH for a number of years until we sort of got through that. So is part of the problem that you've got incumbents here that have got a lot invested in point of sale networks and don't want to switch to EMV and, you know, got a lot invested in their check business, so don't necessarily want to move that to mobile payments? Is that part of the problem with a sort of consensus-led approach to standards?
So I don't know if I'd categorize it as a problem, certainly a challenge that needs to be worked through. You have a lot of investment in legacy infrastructure. You've got P&L that affects things down the line. So folks have to be cognizant of that, but that doesn't mean we can't evolve and move into new capabilities. It really ends up at the end of the day is, you know, what are the demands and the drivers that the consumers and businesses are looking for? Mm. So meeting those requirements that they're asking for, we talk about the digital world. Everybody's got one of those phones in their hand now, pretty much. Folks are used to the instant access to communication, to information, to you name it. But when it comes to
paying, shouldn't it be the same for
money? Why shouldn't it be the same for money? So taking a look at that, you know, folks are saying, hey, there's an opportunity here to make improvements. And that's really what the task force was driven is, you know, how do we make those improvements? What advances need to be done in this collaborative environment, market-driven space to help facilitate that short of a mandate?
I would add to that that there's aside from the competitive side of companies and strength and money and numbers, is that we all feel this on a regular basis. There's an inherent psychological resistance to change. As the old adage is, don't fix what's not broken. Right? There's a lot of people making a lot of money doing the same thing that they've done for 40 years, right? And they have a lot of control, a lot of power. So, you know, imagine a world where you could actually come together in a, you know, I'm going to overuse a word, but a marketplace that allows that to happen. And almost in the way that the Federal Reserve sponsored it. I've been to a lot of governmental events or some sanctioned, some not, activities, even ones that are disturbing. you know, when Dodd-Frank rolled out and things of that nature, that this was unlike anything I've ever seen, right? And I've told them over and over again, the way it was conducted, and it was a lot of thought put into allowing us to really create an environment. Was there some of those people that were sitting there banging on the tables going, you can't do that, because they were more interested in losing their business? Yes, right? But as long as you created a situation in our current economy where everybody can still walk away and then also realize that change is coming. So what forces your psychological to change something when you're stuck? It's either fear, you know, or love. So either you love to do something and you go after that unity and trying to make something better.
You're getting very philosophical.
I was going to say, I don't know how you follow fear and love.
Well, I tell you, because fear is a driving force. The fear of being left behind.
FOMO. Right?
Fear of missing. That's a real fear that will make people move and change. And so what I'm advocating is there is, and I would say there's, it is coming, an environment that would allow for that to happen, where everybody in the ecosystem today still plays. But then in some cases, like a very large bank just called me here in the city a couple weeks ago, we understand where things are going. And we do understand that.
So let's hone in on that for a second, because I met in November of last year, I visited Shenzhen in China, and I met the CEO and chairman of China Merchants Bank, one of the largest, the fifth largest bank in China. And we were talking, and I was talking about some of the stuff that's happening in fintech around the world and so forth. And he stopped me, waved his hand, and he said, no, tell me how we beat BAT, right? And BAT is like the gaffer of the United States. You know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple is, you know, all the FANG stocks, right? Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. But in China, it's BAT, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent. So he wanted to know how they could compete with these guys. And so I started talking to him about strategies to make payments richer and things like that. He waved his hand again. He said, no, you don't understand. The banks in China have already lost payments to the technology companies. We're not in payments anymore. I'm worried about losing credit. Right? Now, that was, for me, that was an incredible insight from a CEO of a major bank in China. But it does occur that if you look globally around the payments networks that are getting the fastest scale in growth these days, M-Pesa in Kenya, Paytm in India, Kakao in Korea, Alibaba and Tencent in China, these are all technology or IP-based networks that are not bank-owned. But right now we have somewhat of a resistance to this approach in the US, where we tend to favor the incumbent networks. When do you think that's going to come to a crunch? When are we going to get to that point where we, you know, the players in this ecosystem are going to have to accept that the technologies we use for payments in the future, things like our mobile phone, aren't ever going to be a bank-owned, technology?
So I'd like to kind of start, and you can add some comments if you want. I think one of the things that's going on in Europe is interesting, because that was
the open banking,
right. And this is the APIs for every bank, and really is driven by the ownership of the information that's required. Because in Europe, you own your data, you own your personal data, your banking data, and you can extract it and move it at any point in time. So the regulation was to say that you can move any time you want. So as a result, technology-wise, banks have to have an API by a certain date that, in an essence, a brand new bank, or if they wanted to move their account, they can literally suck it out and stick it somewhere else within seconds. And so they're not stuck to any one particular place, and it's their data. So what's, you know, while we don't have that same type of regulation and haven't in the U.S. and in that vein, I think it has a huge impact to the understanding of interoperability and ubiquity as it relates to not only coverage and access, but probably more importantly, is the fact that it creates that innovative type of way to grow. The reason why Alipay has grown like that is it's an open source type of model. So, you know, you put something out there, and we'll just use this as an example. A gentleman created a code and threw it in an open code base, and it got extracted, and now there's a thing called Bitcoin and blockchain that's consuming every newscast, every feed out there.
Have you heard the rumor that Satoshi is not actually one guy, he's four?
Oh, I wouldn't surprise me. Soon he'll be Santa Claus. But when you put something out there and allow the community to build on it, you can't control it. It has a momentum of its own. Right. And that's kind of what's happened, right?
Yeah.
Is because they didn't have anything and they had wallets. And so everybody adopted that quickly. And so,
like, they weren't writing checks to pay landlords and things
right.
like that.
Right. So, you know, I talk about this theoretical aspect because in the end, everything about payments is adoption. If you don't have adoption, then you might as well go home, because it's not going to happen. So, you know, psychology has a lot to do with how people do things and so forth. So that adoption is what drives that. And so when you look at an environment that allows this ecosystem to come together in that sense, and I think the open banking structures is having an influence already, and what's happened, it's not the first time that something has started in another country, especially in Europe, and then migrated and had a huge impact over here. And I think the banks are starting to see that. You know, we work with a bank today that really wants to change their entire model, and they're owned now by a millennial. He actually inherited it from his father. So that's what's going to start happening more and more.
Generational
shift. Different, right? And so then you get a new model, and they're more open to this open idea. And so what do banks really do today, right? They provide lending, and they do credit assessment, and they manage regulatory and things of that nature. And that's what they've done very well, right? And so it's been the source of 10 years. But who runs that tenure and how that's conducted, that can be government sanctioned or what, it doesn't really matter. It's, in the end, it's about the relationship with their customer, whether it be a business or a consumer or whatever, and how you drive that. I've been in payments for a long time, and so I've always believed that payments is really the core of everything, because that's where everything moves at. Everything else is static.
Yeah. So, and maybe I can take it back to the task force perspective too, because by design, the task force was really created to bring in all those different players, all the different thoughts. Mm-hmm. So a third of the task force was actually made up of non-bank providers who, to your point, have got some of these innovative services. We got startups, we got conceptual folks that are trying to create new payment capabilities. They were part of that dialogue. They were sitting at the table next to the, you know, whoever that person was that was banging his fist saying, no way, and saying, hey, wait a second, here's what we've got. We've got this great idea, great potential solution. Let's talk about it. So being able to have that dialogue amongst different participants, getting the ideas out on the table. We had a number of proposals that were brought forth before the task force to say, all right, here's kind of the idea behind what real-time payments could be for the U.S. Now, service providers, whoever you are, whether you're a fintech, an existing legacy provider, show us how you could potentially meet the needs for the U.S. marketplace. And they came forth with 22 different proposals to say, you know, here's different ways that we can achieve this. But to your point, to driving adoption, one of the ways to do that is through interoperability. So certainly in the marketplace, you named a number of players in those other countries. It's not likely that we're going to have one provider or one player here in the U.S. There's going to be multiple. So how do we drive to that? How do we create interoperability between some of these different players? Because that's going to help to drive adoption. And to your point, you can't have adoption if people aren't going to start to use the services, which means there has to be some benefit for them in order to use those services.
So, you know, in the UK and much of Europe, effectively to move people off checks, what they did is they started allowing banks, or they essentially mandated these new real-time payment services like you know, SEPA and so forth. But at the same time, they allowed banks to charge for checks, so it became unpopular. You know, that would be a way to motivate people to move from, you know, legacy payments architectures in the US to mobile payments. But it seems like that sort of move would be untenable here. Could you imagine that happening?
You know, I think you're kind of referring to the way other countries have gone about using mandates versus the approach that we've taken here in the U.S., which is market-driven, helping to drive some adoption through customer change and adoption. But, you know, again, customers are going to go to services that benefit them the most. So if you think about it, there was some surveys or some research that the Fed had done few years ago that really looked at consumer behavior and what they wanted with payments capabilities. And folks, both consumers and businesses, were saying at about a 2/3, 75% clip that we want the ability to make payments in a real-time fashion within shorter than an hour, basically, is what they were saying. But we still write a lot of checks in this country, right? But that, again, is consumer behavior. It's consumer choice that is making those processes. Now, checks have been on the decline for a number of years, certainly within consumers. When's the last time anybody saw a person write a check at the checkout line? You just look 10 years ago, people were there writing out, scribbling their checks, and they're scanning the checks. I don't think I've seen a person write a check in a checkout line in the last 2 years. But we still have a lot of checks. But to your point, there's alternatives that are provided to the consumers to make different choices when it comes to payment types. But they're the ones that are going to drive that behavioral change. It's really not going to be, at least in the U.S., from a mandate standpoint.
And I actually take a different approach to that question a little bit. Because, and it's kind of short and sweet for a change for me, is that while it might work in other countries, since when have we ever seen a regulatory idea actually get executed the way it was intended? So unfortunately, this is not a slam for government in general, but it's very complex and a lot of pulls and from a political perspective one way or another, you know, and I'm not talking about party lines, I'm talking about, you know, lobbying and just different optics of viewpoints. You know, people behave based on what they know and their experience and what they've heard. So that doesn't necessarily make it what's best for the execution. And a perfect example of that is, you know, Dodd-Frank. And so Dodd-Frank had, you know, some teeth in it that hurt some, and some liked it, right? So it all depended on where you were on that value chain. And so I don't know that they ever get executed always as intended, because when you write policy, it is very high level and broad, and it takes a handful of people that really didn't have the original intent to actually get it down to execution. I've been in meetings like that, and those are so subjective. So policy of a mandate of that nature in a complex environment like this would never get executed as intended.
Yeah, and I think, so I'm not commenting on Dodd-Frank specifically, but I think you're talking about the unintended consequences of different things that get pushed forward. So again, trying to build this process from the ground up, getting the input of the corporates, getting the input of the merchants, getting the input of the fintech community to help drive and cast a light on what is needed for the U.S. marketplace is helping to develop that. Now all the service providers can take something and look at it and say, okay, here's what we need to develop for the U.S. marketplace, because as opposed to taking the build it and they will come approach, let's see what they actually want and we'll bring it to them.
Right.
So one of the things we saw off the back of Alipay in China is some very interesting changes in deposit behavior. Alipay launched a savings experience of their own called Yuebao. And today it's the largest money market fund in the world, $185 billion assets under management, primarily because it's sort of plugged in to this mobile payments phenomenon. But that's a very, I mean, you know, let's face it, it's the largest money market fund in the world, beats out JP Morgan's Chase's US Treasury bond market fund they have. That's pretty impressive. But the more interesting aspect is that it's a non-bank entity that owns that massive deposit pool. So we're starting to see technology as it creates these money experiences integrated into architecture like this. And we're certainly going to see it with technologies like, you know, voice and, you know, AI smart assistants in the future and eventually in things like smart glasses. So as these technology layers evolve, you know, these different methods of, you know, creating savings behaviors or accessing credit contextually and so forth, you know, is it going to be a situation in the U.S. where the regulatory environment we have that tends towards structures that were built after the Depression in the 1930s, that the regulation, the regulatory framework that we have in the United States itself needs some pretty significant reform to cope with these new types of, you know, financial use cases and scenarios that are going to emerge?
Yeah, so I can tell you again, from the task force perspective, they identified that as a challenge and how we move forward. And they actually came up with 10 different recommendations on how we navigate through this evolution, I'll call it, as we move into new technologies, new services, new capabilities for making payments. One of those specific recommendations was around a review of the regulatory environment.
Right.
That it needs to be done. You got to look at OFAC. You got to look at all the different, you know, money transmitter laws, everything that's out there that impacts or regulates payment capabilities, to say what potentially needs to be adjusted or change as we move forward into some of these new capabilities. Or do some of the existing regulations, you know, support what's being done? So I think that's kind of one of the next phases of work that needs to be done, is to look at that regulatory environment and say, what do we need to do as an industry to make sure that it's supportive of some of these enhancements and improvements that we're looking
at? It's interesting. This task force you built, it seems very forward-looking in terms of where this is going. But regulation, as you pointed out before, tends to be responsive to shocks in the system, and that's the way it's been built up. But, you know, I don't think it's, you know, if you look at regulators around the world, I don't think you consider regulators as innovators generally. They tend to be quite responsive. How do we make that shift? How do we retool regulators to be more innovative in their thinking about these
changes? So I'd actually pose a question. I was just kind of thinking about something, and you actually probably put this bug in my head, you know, months ago in Miami at another conference.
Yep.
And so, You know, I've always thought about when we're in payments, and a lot of people think of things that, that work together, but fundamentally they don't. Like, for example, our whole system runs on a dual system auth on credit card authorization. You got an authorization and you have settlement. And settlement is the actual funds movement, and it's a completely different process, different timing, everything than the authorization and the person acquiring the goods. So just for a moment, take that away and think about the virtual world versus the banking world as a disconnected layer almost, right? That one floats above the other one. So do we need, really, regulators to be innovative? And you're telling, you know, basically one type of person to be something different, right? You know, I'm an introvert. I need to all of a sudden be a type A. That, I don't know that that's going to work well, but, you know, because there's a need for that to some extent, right? And so is that really, should that be just the actual funds movement? And then the top be more a virtual experience, which still allows you to spend, because then, you know, really who's managing the risk between that of the net is the tech. And so, you know, I know that like us, we take on certain risk and we certain manage those risks, and it's just all about risk management. You can manage just about anything. So I would actually say that maybe we don't, because maybe we're pushing the ball up the wrong hill, right? Because we're trying to, even in the task force, we looked at the entire ecosystem. I mean, everything from the source of funds all the way to the destination on every tenure. I mean, every little leaf was unturned. So are we looking at it wrong, right? So I have a big thing about optics and about perspective and how you see things. And so maybe we should just look at things a little differently than what we're used to, and maybe come up with a model that actually allows for regulation and protection of the real funds and security of any government or agency or entity, while disconnecting the virtual world that allows for the user experience. You live in that.
Sure.
Right? You talk about that a lot. And so the problem is we keep trying to force them together. And I've even talked to you about
right.
that.
Right. Well, so, I mean, the U.S. is supposed to be a free market, right? But right now, it looks like China's a freer market if you take a use case on mobile payments
right.
as an example.
Right. Right.
More free than the U.S. But is that a design problem? You know, this is the way we regulate the market.
Yeah, and, you know, maybe just to add on a little bit of what Travis said, you know, you sound like you're kind of trying to put a square peg in a round hole a little bit there. But, you know, again, one of the approaches that we took with the task force was to be inclusive, which included regulators.
Right.
So having them sit at the table, again, be part of that conversation up front. So as we're starting to talk about and design and think about what a real-time payments capability could be for the U.S., they're sitting right there at the table with the guy pounding the fist and the guy saying, I've got this great new idea. So they can kind of balance all that and get all that different perspective. So having them there at the table may get to a little bit of that, but to Travis's point, may mold them a little bit, but I don't know if it's quite going to be the square peg into the round hole example. But hopefully that gets them involved more in the conversation up front.
Well, some of that evolution, that mix came into, you know, there's another task force, security payment task force, that still is active, and it's an ongoing task force, which, again, Dan and I are both part of that also. But that's probably where the rub really meets in. So in the protection of our environment, in the end, that's where the physical meets the virtual, right? And so, you know, things like personal identity management is going to be so important as we evolve more to the digital society, because
yeah.
I don't know who's on that other end. And I don't know that it is really who you say you are, because
yeah.
for how many years have we had our identity stolen, and how long are they going to set on it and then use it against us later? Right. So yeah, there's all this stuff, and some of the security task force, there's some downright scary stuff coming out of that.
So, you know, you have India right now. They had this demonetization move, and that's obviously created a big impetus for mobile payments. But the other element that's quite interesting in India is they've created this national ID program. And that national ID card they created, the ADAR card, did more for financial inclusion in just a few years than any other methodology they'd use. Now, in the US, we have this problem around financial exclusion because of documentary requirements and things like that. But there is some innovation going on in that sort of non-bank alternative financial services space. So do you think part of it is to maybe have, we've been talking about the OCC, charter and things like that. Do we need some more initiatives like that in the US to allow some of this innovation to take place rather than sort of trying to fit around peg in a square hole in terms of the existing regulation? That seems to be the pattern we've seen in markets like Singapore and London. What do you guys think?
Well, I agree, actually. India started the Payments Bank Initiative, I think it was 4 years ago.
And the challenger banks in the UK.
Right, and so it created this environment. You could almost argue that it's like a perfect sandbox for the government to see what happens. Mm-hmm. And actually, the payments bank didn't really materialize as well as they thought it would, which is why demonetization came into play, and that aspect of it drove it stronger, right? Because his goal there was to try to open that up, and since it didn't work itself, he drove it himself, right? But that access, and I love the idea of the OCC concept, because at least you see what happens, but it immediately got attacked too.
Yeah.
Just like, I think you were talking last night at dinner, how, or maybe it was Jason, it was the aspect of so many things that's got that fault through our ages, right? So the buggy manufacturer's fault about the car, and the phone was then the telegraph. Everybody's always worried about their business, right? And so, but at the end, if we don't evolve, we're gonna die on the vine, right? So the real thing is the evolution of I go back to that psychology of what we want, and the generations, and everybody talks about the millennials, and there's positives and negatives that come out of that, but ultimately what it amounts to
is crazy kids. Huh?
Really, they just like, just give me what I need. Don't bother me with all this other stuff. So they actually, grew up with computers. My kids are right in the middle of that. And at five, I actually had them reformatting OSs on computers. They broke into the elementary school, go figure. It's just, and hacking it. It's just that these kids today, that just comes
what
second
you're saying
nature.
Is your kids are cyber criminals.
Yeah, well, not yet, but yeah.
All right, so yeah. Listen, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I want to give you both this opportunity to sort of wrap it up, but let me sort of frame it in maybe a different way. Looking 5 to 10 years out, based on the work you've done on the task force and the evolution of payment systems we're seeing around the world and so forth, where do you think we're going to be at with mobile payments in 5, 10 years? Give us a sort of 60-second summary.
So you're asking for the crystal ball.
I am.
You are.
You got your finger on the pulse.
I do, but So one of the things that I think is the reality here is that change is coming. Okay, so within the U.S. marketplace, while we've got the task force came up with recommendations. There's some follow-up work to do there. Things are happening in the marketplace as we speak. So things are getting stood up. Capabilities are getting stood up. People are innovating. There's new things happening. The task force goal was to have ubiquitous receipt by 2020. So that's not even 5, 10 years. That's a short three and a half years. So it's going to take a lot of work to get there. But that was the goal that they kind of put out there is the line to shoot for from the U.S. marketplace. And then the recommendations were all aligned to help to support that to get to that capability. So real-time payments are coming. We have them today in what we typically refer to as closed-loop payment communities.
Like
right, exactly. Different services. But if you think about your cell phone or even there's probably a few people here that operated in the debit card space, the ATM card space originally. Remember, you actually had to look on the back of your ATM card to see the logos, the bugs that were on the back to make sure it would work in the machine. Does anybody even think about that anymore? You just put the card in the machine and it works. So capabilities are coming. We have to figure out how we address this interoperability issue. And then the customer experience so that folks are operating in the same space. But things are coming and evolution is on its way in the U.S. market.
Great. Thanks, Tim. Travis, you want to wrap us up?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, from what we were doing with the Federal Reserve, I think a lot of the kinks and manual and error-prone processes will be resolved, you know, 5-10 years. And there might be some cleanup left on the floor, but, you know, the Federal Reserve will, you know, handle that for the most part, because a lot of their work is some of that, right? So, and I would say even Notch's progression of same day and so forth has allowed them to manage even workloads differently, right? Which moves us to more of an instant per transaction kind of movement rather than before. But you talk about mobile wallets, right? So I'm a firm believer, and somebody I said this in a panel earlier, I think, is that the mobile wallet today, and when you think about a wallet, I've said this once, I'll say it always again, I've never see the wallet as an actual product. I see it as a feature functionality. So what I see over the next 5 to 10 years is payments is not going to be an act. Nobody wants to pay for anything. They want to acquire goods. And so the business model of a service bureau and handling payments as a separate thought process will not be the case.
Yeah.
It will be integrated into the business models. It will be integrated in our solutions. We won't think about it. We will move forward. We will have dinner. We will take a taxi. We will go places, and it will happen. And because we will define those as a personal level of how that criteria is managed. I use Uber as a perfect example of that, right? It is a digital wallet, but nobody will ever call it that. But it is a digital wallet that you can catch a taxi with, you know. But in an essence, that is what, you know, people use that for many reasons, for examples. But in the payments world, right, friction is the problem.
Yeah.
You eliminate that and make it an afterthought and making it about what you want to acquire. We have adoption, we have liftoff.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that's the trend we're seeing on a global basis. If you look at these other mobile payments networks who've got these rapid scale, all of them have that one thing in common, that they are removing friction from the system.
Yeah.
And so eventually, I guess that's the customer experience that's going to lead to ubiquitous mobile payments adoption in the US. Thank you both for being on Breaking Banks and participating on the panel today.
Thank you, Brett.
And thank you for hosting us.
Thank you for joining us for this show of Breaking Banks. And thank you for the Mobile Payments Conference for hosting us. We really enjoyed being there in Chicago. Please remember to subscribe to the show and go to iTunes and give us a great review. I would really love that. Have a great week, and we will be here next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time, for more of the latest in fintech news.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.